We're going to be in John chapter 9 for tonight's gospel story. This is another lengthy one. It's 41 verses, and it's the story of the man born blind. There's an old rule for lawyers. Don't ask a question you don't already know the answer to. Sometimes they forgot that with Jesus. They would ask him questions, and 41 verses later, they figured out maybe they hadn't ought to ask that question. But it's good for us. We benefit. We get to learn. So that's what happens in this text. We're going to break it into little pieces and then just kind of do each part of the scene at a time, and I'll have some questions to go along with that as we go. For the sake of just kind of getting it all read together, I'm going to go ahead and do the reading tonight. This will be chapter 9, verses 1 through 7, which is the discussion that leads into the story. As he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth, and his disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Jesus answered, "It was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world." Having said these things, he spit on the ground and made mud with the saliva. Then he anointed the man's eyes with the mud and said to him, "Go, wash in the pool of Siloam," which means sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. So the discussion is about how God does or doesn't work in this world, and why do bad things happen? And that's a pretty important religious question, right? We want to know, why do bad things happen? In the ancient world, just like in the modern world, we tend to think if bad things happen, somebody is to blame, and it's probably you. It's never me, but it's definitely you. You must be to blame. If you're suffering, somebody's to blame, and it's probably you. This is the discussion that takes up 42 chapters of the book of Job, right? Where Job is suffering. How come? Well, his friends say, "Well, we know why. You're a sinner. Just tell us what you did." Job says, "I'd like to believe that, except I sure don't remember sinning. I wish God would come tell me what's going on." And that's the discussion that goes back and forth for 30-some-odd chapters up till chapter 38, and God intervenes and doesn't answer any of the questions, and then the book ends. So that's a tricky book for sure. But that's the basic question that lives on here. Somebody is suffering. Somebody is miserable. And it's bad sin, right? This didn't happen later in life. He was born blind. So normally you'd say, if the person's blind, the blind man must be at fault. But even they realize this is kind of a problem here. He was born blind. He hadn't had time to do anything wrong yet. So this kind of pokes a hole in their normal way of thinking, and they've got a solution, though. We know, parents. This must have been God smiting his parents with a curse for some sin they had committed, that they got a son born blind. And that's a legitimate thought in some sense. If you read the Old Testament, God blesses to the third and fourth generation, and God can curse to the third and fourth generation. Sometimes the consequences of sin do stick around, okay? Fair enough. But Jesus says that's just not the way to look at this tragedy. Jesus explains that this particular malady carries the potential for God's glory. And I want to talk about just briefly what I think that means. I don't believe that God struck the man blind because one of these days Jesus was kind of going to come around and there had to be a blind man for Jesus to heal his blindness. So somebody lives an entire life of blindness so Jesus can do a miracle later in the New Testament. I don't think that's exactly his point. I think he's making a more general point, and that is there is no opportunity for great goodness in the world if God does everything for us. So with your kids, if you do everything for them, when do they get opportunities to do good things and learn how to do good? They don't, right? They don't. They never have that opportunity. By doing everything for your children, you're actually robbing them of opportunities to work. In the New Testament, work is something that brings God glory. So especially if you look at the end of verse 3 and then verse 4, that the works of God might be displayed in him. It's the works that's important. It's the opportunity. Every bad thing that happened is an opportunity for you to do something good. And then verse 4, we must work the works of him who sent me. Notice the pronouns there. He doesn't say, I must work the works of him who sent me. He says, we must work the works of him who sent me. So the one who sent me is God, that's fine. But we are supposed to be doing good works. That's what God wants us to do. If there's no danger in the world, there's no opportunity for bravery. If there's no poverty in the world, there's no opportunity for generosity. If there's no sickness in the world, there's no opportunity for great works of healing. And that's true whether you're the Messiah or not. So I don't think this is a particular point about just Jesus. God struck a man blind so that Jesus could heal him. It's a bigger question. Why do bad things happen? For Jesus, the question is, maybe better stated, why doesn't God intervene in every instance of awfulness in the world? And I think the answer, or at least part of it, I don't think there's a whole answer, but partial answer, is that God is allowing us opportunities to do good works. In the same way that a parent allows a child to face obstacles on his own sometimes. The difference is that the size of these obstacles seem unfair to us. But I'll remind you, when you were a kid, the size of the obstacles your parents gave you also seemed unfair. Right? Everything seems unfair when you're going through it. So Jesus looks at this differently. God is glorified when people works his works. And so here's another way to look at it. In the story of Job, the friends say, well, who sinned? It must have been you, Job. Job says, I don't know, maybe God got it wrong. In the story of Jesus and the blind man, Jesus says, let's just do something good instead, and he heals him. In the story of Job, why didn't Job's friend just help him? Everything's going terrible. And they want to sit around and figure out whose fault it is. Jesus says, we can just slice through that problem. This is an opportunity to do something good. Never mind whose fault it is. You're missing the point. We do a lot of that. If you look at kind of our social debates, I mean, it really doesn't matter. It could be race-related, poverty-related, immigration-related. I mean, you pick the topic, and all the political intelligentsia wants to talk about in all parties is, whose fault is it and who can we have fix it, right? Who's responsible for this? And Jesus would probably say, I don't know, go do something good. Go help somebody. If somebody's poor, feed them. That would be a solution, right? How did they get poor? I'm not sure yet. We'll work on that tomorrow. Today, can we feed some people? There are people who are mistreated. Whose fault is it? Well, I don't know. We'll figure that out tomorrow. Today, let's treat them right. And that seems to be Jesus' solution to everything. Let's do good instead, and we'll figure the rest out later. Or better yet, let God figure it out, because he's smarter than us. The question I had for some discussion is this the way you look at tragedies in your life? It's always easier when it's a character in the story in the Bible. Say, so, yeah, that blind guy, or Job really should have known, right? It's always easier when it's him. When you face a tragedy in your life, are you able, or have you, you're permitted a small amount of storytelling in answer to this question, but not a long story, a short story. Have you been through something that you did come to learn was an opportunity for goodness that brought glory to God, and that was a more productive response for you than saying, who's to blame for this? Whose fault is it? Any thoughts of that? Jerry?
Five got laid off. That's me.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm in my thought back at home. So I quit there, went back home. All three opportunities fell through.
Yeah, of course they did.
Well, eventually things worked out for the better. And looking back at it, I could sit and stew about this all day long.
Yeah.
But go out and do something. Well, what I did is go get part-time jobs, or temporary, until something opened up. And something, one place I was saying, job, got retired.
Yeah.
Guess what?
So after time, just to reinforce this point, I wouldn't point to any of those and say, God laid you off so that you could, do this. I don't think that's the way it works. But why does God permit us to face obstacles? And it seems that often we do benefit in some ways from them, either through learning character traits that are helpful or finding new opportunities that we might not have considered if things had all gone smoothly. And he would have just intervened and said, when they pass the paperwork down to lay you off, God says, nope, not Jerry, I like him. See that? Think of what would have been different. Yeah. David?
A couple of situations I've been in, it certainly caused you to ask the question,
yeah,
do I believe what I've been taught to? Because your faith is being tested.
Mm-hmm.
And either you can blame someone else, or you can look to the goodness of God. And in situations I was in, I think I played the poor pitiful me for a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
I found out I had cancer. And then decided that was nonsense, because I had been raised to trust in God. And if I'm not going to use that now, when am I going to use it?
Yeah, what was it for? Yeah.
And so I think through that, it helped me grow spiritually. And so from which point do you view tragedy?
Yeah.
I know in my life it has helped me spiritually.
The book we used, remember a couple of months ago we did a series on prayer, and one of the books that I read through quite a lot in preparation for that was Timothy Keller's book on prayer. And his introductory chapter is that story. He had a cancer diagnosis. Now, here he is, a prominent Presbyterian pastor in a church with thousands, doing as good as he could, you would think, for a religious clergy-type person. He got diagnosed with cancer and realized, I don't really pray, ever. He said, I didn't learn to pray. Even as a religious minister-type person, I didn't learn to pray until after cancer. Now, again, to be clear, I don't believe God gave David or Timothy Keller cancer to teach them something. But why does God permit things like that to happen? They are opportunities for growth and for goodness from others sometimes, not just ourselves, but from others. They allow others to bless us. If we don't allow others to bless us, we fall into the delusion that I don't need anybody's help. But when you, in fact, do, you learn some humility and you learn about the goodness of others and make a friend, and who knows what else follows from that.
And that was going to, I was just going to make that point, that was very humbling.
Yeah.
To know that there were hundreds of people praying on my behalf.
Yeah.
And that is very, very
humbling. Yeah, it is. One more. Jared, you had your hand up. So when we do marital counseling from time to time with people who are really struggling in marriage, one thing I often remind them is when you get over this hump and you're going to 5 or 6 years, remember all this, and someone's going to need a conversation from you that someone else shared with you, this time around. So absolutely. Good thoughts. Okay. So the miracle that transpires is really simply stated in verse 7. go wash in the pool of Siloam, and he goes, and he came back seen. So in verses 8 through 12, there's some discussion about what just happened. It almost happened with so little fanfare that they have to blink and go back and say, now what just happened exactly? So here's 8 through 12. The neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar were saying, is this not the man who used to sit and beg? And some says, it is he. Others said, no, but he is like him. He kept saying, I am the man. So they said to him, then how are your eyes opened? And here's his answer. The man called Jesus made mud and anointed my eyes and said to me, go to Siloam and wash. So I went and washed and received my sight. They said to him, where is he? He said, I don't know. I love when the miracle stories are just bare bones. When no, there's nothing there. If you were writing even good fiction, if you're trying to make up a good Messiah, man, there was a puff of smoke and there was a bolt of lightning. And instead, you get these stories, and even it happens so simply, even the people it happens to aren't exactly sure what to tell you. Listen, he made some mud, he put it on my eyes, I washed it off, and then I saw. I can't even tell you where he is. I know that he's called Jesus. That's all I know. Right? It's just that straightforward and simple. It's so simple that people have trouble believing it. Reality is it's hardest to believe when it's simple, right? This simply can't be the man. Maybe he is. Maybe it's one that looks like him. And the man says, I am who I am. That's it. Okay. So the miracle is pretty understated. The blind man is made into a new man. I don't even recognize him, right? He's now a seeing man, a person who sees. Even his mannerisms are different than a man who is blind. And so the people are not even sure it's the same. Can't possibly be the same person. There's a little play on words. There's a little pun in the Greek text that spells it out for you in the English text. He sent him to the pool of Siloam. Siloam means sent. So he sent him to the pool of sent. And when he went to the pool of sent, that's when he could see, and he came back. So he had to go. He was sent to the pool of sent. So John thinks that's funny, so there you go, play on words. Question for us. Now, you had James going on in the Sunday morning auditorium class, and there, I'm guessing, are you guys in chapter 2 yet? Not yet? Okay. Well, you're about to be. And before you get done with chapter 2, you're going to be talking about faith and works if you're not already. It comes up all the way through James. And this is an interesting story to exemplify that. Two questions I want to ask about this very simple story, just 4 or 5 verses. How was the man healed? When was the man healed? Question 1. How was the man healed? And don't overthink it too much. It's going to be pretty straightforward. Okay, somebody said, I got 2 answers. Well, power of God and by his belief that it could be done. I do think he believed something, or at least was desperate enough to feign belief, one or the other. But it was the power of God, right? We all recognize. How many other people could have put mud on his eyes and got nowhere? Do you think for a moment, if you put mud on somebody's eyes, that suddenly they're going to be seen instead of blind? Do you think if you go down even to the pool of Siloam and wash it off, that suddenly it'll be all? Of course not. We recognize that the only way this could have happened is the power of God. It's the grace of God. Without any question, God has done this as it came into contact with the man's faith. That's what took place. Question 2. When did the grace of God cause him to see? After he did what he was told. And so, to be clear, I think we kind of get caught up in those discussions sometimes. Do you suppose there was anybody, do you suppose the blind man ever said, no, Jesus didn't do anything. I went down to that pool and washed it off, and that's what made me see. Nobody in their right mind thinks that's what happened. I mean, that's never a discussion. If you read this entire chapter, nobody says, I'll tell you what happened was he washed really good. He just never washed his eyes before. Right? Nobody thinks that this man's obedience had the power to make him see. At the same time, nobody reading the story thinks that if the man had said, no, I'm not going to the pool you sent me to, that he would have been seen. And this really, if you can remember this when you get to James chapter 2, is I think the way James sees faith and works. He just can't imagine them being separated, and nobody would. How are we saved from our sins? By the grace of God. Nothing but the grace of God. Nothing you could do could possibly manage to do what God's grace does. We could build 1,000 baptistries, and I'd put you in it 1,000 times if you want. We can baptize you till you drown. Nothing can save you but the grace of God. Now, question two, when do we come into contact with God's saving grace? Scriptures say, well, in baptism, you come up a new man. So there seems to be, to me, a connection. One is a question of how, and another is a question of, okay, when do I become part of that? But it never should distract us from the how. In this story, no one's talking about washing mud off eyes. They're asking, what has this man, Jesus, done? Because that's where the power is. And everyone knows it. No one thinks. There's not even one verse that suggests we need to investigate that pool. Must be something special in the water. No one suggested. The power of God in Jesus Christ makes that possible. Naaman the leper? Yeah, very similar. Okay, chapter 9. This is the lengthy section. We're going to have a couple of questions out of this, so just kind of take some mental notes as we go. 13 through 34. This is where everything gets complicated when the Pharisees get involved. The miracle's simple. Then religious people get involved, and it suddenly becomes complicated. They brought to the Pharisees the man who had formerly been blind. Now it was a Sabbath day when Jesus made the mud and opened his eyes. So the Pharisees again asked him how he had received his sight. And he said to them, he put mud on my eyes and I washed and I see. Again, and John, this is almost funny to me, just how simple the verbs are. It's see, spot, run. I mean, it's he made mud, he put it on my eyes, I washed it off, I can see now. It's just that straightforward. He doesn't embellish it. Anyway. Some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath. But others said, how can a man who is a sinner do such signs? And there was a division among them. So they said again to the blind man, what do you say about him, since he has opened your eyes? And he said, he is a prophet. The Jews did not believe that he had been blind and had received his sight, until they called the parents of the man who had received his sight and asked him, is this your son, who you say was born blind? How then does he now see? His parents answered, we know that this is our son and that he was born blind. But how he now sees, we do not know, nor do we know who opened his eyes. Ask him, he is of age, he will speak for himself. His parents said these things because they feared the Jews. For the Jews had already agreed that if anyone should confess Jesus to be Christ, he was to be put out of the synagogue. Therefore, his parents said, he is of age, ask him. So for the second time, they called the man who had been blind and said to him, give glory to God, we know this man is a sinner. Now, if you're not feeling like Job at this point, you're really missing it, right? So we know this man is a sinner. He answered, whether he is a sinner, I do not know. One thing I do know, that though I was blind, now I see. They said to him, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? And he answered them, I have told you already and you would not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciples? They thought that was great. They reviled him, saying, you are his disciples, but we are the disciples of Moses. We know what God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we do not know where he comes from. The man answered, why, this is an amazing thing. You do not know where he comes from, and yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners, but if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, God listens to him. Never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. And they answered him, you were born in utter sin, and you would teach us? And they cast him out. That's just a fun section to me. You couldn't write better comedy. And what's sad about it is so exactly like human characteristic. It's exactly how we act. It's only funny when other people do it. We could say, well, they're so dishonest. And actually, it's the way we think more often than not. What's important to the Pharisees? Start back at 14 through 16. A man has been healed who is born blind. What's the most important part of that story to the Pharisees? Did it on the Sabbath day. Did that even come up in the first 12 verses? Never comes up. Do you think the blind man stopped him and said, whoa, what day is it? Never occurs to anybody until the Pharisees say, whoa, wait a second. This is a Sabbath day. Can't do that. They are deeply concerned not about what a profoundly powerful, unheard of miracle might mean, but what day it was that he did it. What are the tools of the Pharisees? How do they get their way in this story? You can especially look at 20 through 23. How do they get their way? How do they push their weight around? Power to cast out of the synagogue. Fear and intimidation. If your response to very simple information is, we can fix this with fear and intimidation, you are more like the Pharisees than you like to know. Okay? No one here is trying to manipulate them. People are going out of their way to give simple answers so as not to provoke them. Even if you look back in, let me find the right verse here. Verse 17, does the blind man say that this is the Christ? He says the nicest thing he can say about him without calling him Christ. Because he knows that that's a hot button issue. That is going to start a fight. So he doesn't say that. He says, well, he's a prophet. Could we at least agree on that much? He's a prophet. That's not offensive to anybody, is it? Apparently so. Fear and intimidation. Why do they ask him the same questions twice? Were they hard of hearing? Why do you ask the same questions twice? You don't like the first answer. And we want to know if you're going to stick to your story. And I'm not trying to pick on police officers, but do police detectives do this? If they have a suspect they think has done something, call him in and ask some questions. Wait a little while, they'll call him back in and see if he answers the same way. It's a tactic to because you're just not satisfied with what you heard so far. In this case, this fellow just had the misfortune of being healed by Jesus. It's only crime. And so they're going to say, we'll call him again. They go to great, let's find his parents. And that part cracks me up. This man who you say is your son. That's, which old comedy was it where they... You know, the lawyer, the detective would say, if that's your real name, right? You know, everything was subject to doubt. Everything was a possible lie. This man that you say is your son, was he actually born blind? And they say, all we know, he's our son and he was blind. Everything else you have to ask him. We're not getting into this. Brave parents, right? Because, again, fear and intimidation were the tactics of the Pharisees. The church needs to be careful. Fear and intimidation are not the tactics of the church. Honesty and candor, like the other people in this story, are the tools of the church. Fear and intimidation are not. What are the Pharisees doing with their assertions? Look at some of their statements. Verse 24, give glory to God. We know that this man is a sinner. Verse 28 and 29, you are his disciple, but we are the disciples of Moses. We know what God has spoken to Moses, but we don't know about this man. And then verse 34, you were born in sin, and so you can't teach us. What kind of statements are those? If you take a logic class, this would be called maybe the black-white fallacy, where I ask you, what color is this chair? Is it black or is it white? So I'm going to give you two options, and you have to pick. I've limited your options. It looks kind of brown to me, but I didn't give you brown as an option. You see, I've limited it. I've cut it down. These are also sometimes complex questions. A complex question is when you ask a question that already has the answer built in. Okay? Have you stopped beating your wife yet? Well, if I say yes, that means I used to beat her. If I say no, then I'm still beating her. There wasn't an answer in that question that says, I never beat my wife, right? The question was a complex question. It had bad answers built into the question. So what do they say? Verse 24, give glory to God. We know this man is a sinner. Either you can glorify God like we do and agree that this man is a sinner, or else if you believe in this man, you must not glorify God. Well, what if I want to glorify God and believe in this man? Right? Well, they didn't give him that option. You can glorify God with us and know that this man is a sinner, or you can be one of those people that don't respect God. And we do this sometimes in religious debates. If you don't agree with me, you must be irreverent if you don't agree with me, you must not love God like I do, right? And that's kind of, they're giving him two options. Either you love God and agree with me, or you don't. Well, that's a trap. There's no right answer out of that. In verse 28 and 29, you're his disciple, we follow Moses. Well, okay, they know it's right to follow Moses. God spoke to Moses. Nothing wrong with Moses. But what have they done? Either you follow Moses or you follow Jesus. You can't do both. What would Jesus have said to that? Follow Moses, follow Jesus, right? You don't have to pick at this particular moment in history. If you were to follow and believe Moses, you would believe in Jesus. Moses would believe in Jesus. But they give this option. Pick one. You either have to pick Moses or this man. Which one? See? And then again in the end of that, verse 34, you're in sin, you can't teach us. That's a personal, ad hominem attack is the Latin fancy phrase. You're attacking the person. Do you believe me, or do you believe the dirty, no-good person, Keith Riggs? Which one is it? You see what I did there? I poisoned the well. I told you right up front, well, I'm a good person and you're bad, so who do you believe? So in front of the other people, they say, well, you're a sinner, so you can't tell us anything. I got news for you. If the devil tells you the truth, it's still the truth. I don't think the devil tells us the truth very often, but I'm just saying, truth is truth is truth. Balaam was corrected by a donkey. It really doesn't matter where it comes from. Truth is truth is truth. Well, you're a sinner. Okay, fine. I was a sinner who was born blind, and now I can see. Does that change any of the facts of the story? Nope. Just a diversion. What can we learn from this man's response? Verses 30 through 33. He's pretty funny to me. I like that phrase about, well, maybe you want to be his disciple. He's gone to meddling now. He's run out of patience with him. But in 30 through 33, he says, you know, let's just walk through this a minute. What do we believe? Do we believe that people can work miracles because they serve Satan so much? No. Do we believe the prophets of Baal can do miracles? Now, we saw that at Mount Carmel. It doesn't work that way. If this man was a blasphemer of God, could he work miracles? Would that be what we would expect? That's not what we're trained to expect. Quite the opposite. When someone does something that nobody else but God can do, what we're trained to expect is that he's from God. That's the normal conclusion. Now, there might be, if you wanted to, we're out of time, but if we wanted to have a 30-minute argument, we might could poke some holes in that. You know, is there any example? Could there be a way out? Maybe. But what he's saying is, as a general rule, someone does a miracle, what do we assume? They're from God. That's normal. What reason do we have to doubt that in this case? Mostly that you just don't like him. And that's what it comes down to. Completely out of time, but let me move ahead and just mention how the story ends, the 35 through 41. Jesus comes to the man again. I'll just read it. Jesus heard that they had cast him out, and having found him, he said, do you believe in the Son of Man? And he answered, who is he, sir, that I may believe in him? Jesus said to him, you have seen him, and it is he who is speaking to you. This is the first time the man ever saw Jesus. Before, put the mud in his eyes, he's blind. He goes down to the temple of Siloam. He's never seen Jesus with his healed eyes before. And he comes back and he says, show me who he is, I'll believe him. And he says, you've seen him. This is it. Similar to what he says to the woman at the well. He that speaketh to thee am he. The one speaking to you right now is him. The person you're looking at right now. And so the story ends with a comparison between the blindness of the Pharisees and the sight of the blind man. And I'll just read that and that'll be yours. He said, Lord, I believed, and he worshipped him. Jesus says, for judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind. Some of the Pharisees near him heard these things and said to him, are we also blind? And Jesus said to them, if you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say we see, your guilt remains. Well, there's your riddle to take home. Thanks for your attention and comments. Appreciate it.